The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host, Jeff Sturdivant, and tonight we have something special in store. Not only is this episode 350 a milestone in our long tradition of terrifying tales, but we're also welcoming back a fan favorite guest. If you tuned into episode 336, Gathered Shadows, you'll remember this voice. His performance left quite the chilling impression. And if you missed that one, be sure to go back and check it out after tonight's show. He's a seasoned audio engineer, producer, and voice actor with great hair, whose YouTube channel, The Ghost of 94, is known for its cinematic horror experiences. From solo narrations to full cast productions, complete with his own original music and immersive sound design. So please, welcome back the illustrious, the magnificent, Felipe Ojeda.
Thank you. Everybody calm down. I'm not that big a deal. Jeff, thanks for having me back. It's an honor to be part of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights again. I couldn't think of a better way to celebrate episode 350. For those of you who don't know me, my horror journey started when I was working construction. Spending long hours on the road, listening to creepypastas and horror narrations, it wasn't long before I wanted to try my hand at it myself. So I then proceeded to get a college education. I studied commercial music and sound engineering, and in 2015 I got my big break with Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, working as an audio engineer and producer for the Simply Scary podcast. From there, I helped shape the sound of several horror productions before launching my own channel, The Ghost of 94. Now, I create everything from traditional horror narrations to full-scale audio dramas. The kind of horror that pulls you in and doesn't let go.
And if you love cosmic horror, creature features, or a good old-fashioned slasher, The Ghost of 94 is where you'll want to be. Before we begin tonight's tales, a quick reminder that your support is what keeps Chilling Tales for Dark Nights alive. If you enjoy what we do, please take a moment to leave us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening. And if you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit that thumbs up, drop a comment, and subscribe with notifications on. That way you won't miss a single nightmare. And if you want even more chilling content, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to become a patron and enjoy ad-free episodes. Your support keeps the darkness alive. Thank you. To kick things off, our first tale tonight explores what happens when the barrier between life and death begins to blur. A man is drawn into his friend's dangerous obsession with the afterlife and learns the hard way that something should never be pursued. From the mind of Michael Whitehouse, as performed and produced by Felipe Ojeda, I present to you, Is There Life After Death?
I've told this story many times, and without exception has provoked the same reaction. Disbelief. No matter how difficult it is for people to process, and no matter how many conventional explanations have been offered, this did happen, and it's an experience I will never forget. It started with a friend of mine, Stuart, who had always been interested in the supernatural. I, on the other hand, had no more interest in it than the next person. Of course, I'm curious about whether there is life after death, and for selfish reasons. But I prefer to leave those things to themselves, as I find the entire subject morbid. I'm sure I'll learn the truth in the end, but until that day, I'd rather not ask the question for fear of the answer. Either way. Stuart was captivated by the paranormal. He lived and breathed it. But our friendship had developed through another of his passions, film. And although he often asked me to go on one of his investigations, I always replied that I preferred such things to remain on the cinema screen and to stay there. We'd go for a few beers regularly at Farland's Bar on the main street or catch a film at the local cinema with some mutual friends. Then, suddenly, I didn't see or hear from him for a couple of weeks, which was peculiar, but I assumed he was simply busy, and so I left it at that. It was 3:04 a.m. when he called. Hello. I was angry at first that he'd woken me, but when I heard the sound of his voice, anger quickly bled into concern. Stuart was always such an upbeat guy, but that night his voice sounded distant, and there was a new uncertainty I'd never sensed before, which quivered underneath each word, unsettling me.
I need you to come get me,
he said in a low whisper.
What's wrong? Where are you?
I asked.
I can't talk for long. Just come to the old botanical gardens at the edge of town.
His breath became increasingly labored and agitated as he spoke.
Stuart, if you're in trouble, call the police.
No!
He exclaimed in a unique mix of whisper and shout.
I'm not meant to be here. They'll arrest me. Just come to the botanical gardens and send me a text when you're waiting outside. I have to go.
And with that, he hung up. 10 minutes later, I was in my car and driving to the edge of Windrum Town. It was an autumn night, and as I passed landmarks which were usually familiar to me during the day, each twisted tree branch and leaf-covered garden took on a more threatening nature than I was used to, the night revealing an unapparent side of the town I loved. It seemed strange to me that Stuart would be in the botanical gardens at night. He quite regularly went away on nocturnal investigations of abandoned hospitals and other supposedly haunted locations. But that place didn't seem like an obvious choice for such things. In the past, the gardens housed beautiful exotic trees, plants, and wildlife under a massive greenhouse, which must have been over 200 feet in length. But it had been shut down for a few decades. I guess the townsfolk didn't frequent it enough to keep it afloat. Even when I was a kid, the place was just fodder for a rock or two, shattering many of the countless panes of glass, each held in place by a rusted frame. Although, admittedly, my throw fell short more often than not. I know my dad talked about going there when he was a kid, amazed by the place. A self-contained tropical landscape, even during Windrum's bleakest winters. I pulled up in front of a large metal fence. encircling what was left of the botanical gardens and its grounds, no doubt to dissuade newer generations of rock throwers. On its gate hung a mud-smeared sign displaying the words, "No trespassing," in no uncertain terms. Stuart obviously hadn't bothered with the warning, no doubt more interested on catching a glimpse of something otherworldly inside. I left the engine running, as it was a little cold out. But just as I unlocked my phone, I received a text message.
"Kill your lights."
And so I did. Then another message quickly followed.
"Don't call me whatever you do."
I began to develop a distinct impression that Stuart and I were not the only ones present out there in the night. A nervousness crept into my breath. And as I sat there looking into the darkness of the gardens, partially obscured by a web of fencing, I felt as though something was staring back. For a moment, I was unsure how to proceed, but was then startled by another text message, and frightened by the thought that Stuart was in there somewhere, and about to be grabbed by a burly security guard, a local gang or worse. I adhered to his instructions.
"Just follow my light and get me the hell out of here."
And there it was, Stuart's torch flickering for a brief moment before being engulfed by the darkness once more. I opened the car door, the night uncomfortably cold as it washed over me. Just 30 minutes earlier, I'd been cozy, sleeping in my bed. And now this, climbing over a fence and walking into God knows what. The fence rattled as I pulled myself up. And as I reached the top, I looked across the pitch night and seriously reconsidered going any further. Then, Stuart's torchlight flashed again, and I knew I couldn't leave him, possibly injured or trapped, with the chilled October air threatening worse. I jumped down from the fence as quietly as I could, my feet muffled by the whispering grass below. The ground was wet, and the unattended grass and bushes which surrounded the main building made progress difficult. The light flashed again. 3 times, in fact, before Stuart turned it off once more. I was sure now that he was growing more agitated, so I continued in the direction of the once glass building to reach my friend as quickly as possible. But my footsteps were uncertain, and my eyes struggled to pierce the dark. I took out my phone and used the LED light on its back to see where I was going. As I walked toward the large shadowed outline of the garden building, I grew increasingly apprehensive. There were only 3 possible reasons why Stuart turned on his torch intermittently. One was that he had broken it somehow. Perhaps he could only get it to flicker into life every few minutes. Another explanation would be that the battery was low. Perhaps he was lost and switched it off to conserve what little juice it had left. The last explanation was a less appealing one. I switched off my light at the thought of it. Perhaps he didn't want to draw too much attention to his location. Maybe he was frightened that someone else would find him first. The darkness stood before me, a wall of black which blanketed all. It was hopeless. I was going to have to switch the light on to see where I was going. I remembered when I was 14 and had nearly fallen down an old drainage shaft when I was camping at night with friends. I always shuddered thinking about that, about how bad that fall could have been. I needed to see where I was going. If a security guard came and found me, then that was the better outcome than falling into the darkness somewhere, unseen. And yet, the thought of a night guard seemed far-fetched. The old building had been derelict for years, and it seemed unlikely that the town would waste money on wages for someone to patrol the area at night. Finally, I reached the building, its base made out of red brick, which had held up surprisingly well for all the years of its neglect. The same cannot be said for the frame. Large metal struts reached up to the sky, forming a huge domed roof. I could see pieces of the frame lying on the floor, and in the dim light of my phone, I thought I saw strands of it hanging from the roof. Just waiting to break off and impale any unwelcome trespassers. I cringed at the thought of my friend lying somewhere inside, perhaps impaled or trapped by falling metal and masonry. Stuart's light flickered again, and then disappeared. It was indeed coming from inside, and as I ducked under and then through one of the countless empty metal frames, I realized that he was somewhere in the middle of the building. Despite having no solid walls, there was an echo of sorts to the place. Subtle. My footsteps ricocheting gently off the concrete floor, and then filtering out into the bleakness of the night. That was when I first noticed it. The cold. Sure, it was always cold in October, but I slowly proceeded, shards of broken glass cracking occasionally under my weight. A chill in the air grew more pronounced. It bit at my exposed face, and I was convinced that if I looked in a mirror, my nose would have been bright red. There, Stuart's light. It was closer now, and for the first time I saw the light reflect upwards for a moment and illuminate Stuart's outline. As I drew nearer, the night closed in, and the cold was now becoming almost unbearable. My hands ached from the bones outward, and the air froze my insides with each breath. I was now only a few meters away from the center of that old glassless dome and my friend. The light flickered again, but it seemed obscured somehow, as if Stuart had turned his back on me, the light from his torch bathing him in illumination for only the briefest of seconds.
Stuart, it's Mike. Are you okay?
I said softly.
Yes, let's get the hell out of here,
he replied nervously. Then a new noise joined us. As I opened my mouth to whisper across to Stuart and ask him if he was hurt, the sound of broken glass breaking under weight echoed from behind. It came from somewhere behind us and was subtle at first, but there was no doubt. I could hear movement. Yes, footsteps, more pronounced. They were moving toward us. Then they stopped. All I could hear was my heart thumping, the adrenaline of apprehension coursing through my veins. Quickly, I switched off the light from my phone, hoping to obscure our location.
Someone else is here,
I said.
I know. They've been wandering around me for hours,
whispered Stuart. Then the footsteps moved again, this time circling, prowling under the cover of night. I knew then why Stuart had called me. Someone was taunting him. They had been in the broken glass dome all along, terrifying my friend and me in the process. No doubt he had been terrified, but now there were two of us, and whoever was circling, they were surely but one. I decided we would act, pick a direction and stick to it. I moved close to my friend and whispered,
"Follow me."
Sure.
That word still haunts me. The light from Stuart's torch came on once more, but you see, it wasn't a torch. And whoever I was standing right in front of was not my friend Stuart. A strange light emanated from inside the throat of what I can only describe as the figure of a woman. The light bled out through translucent skin, which seemed to take on the appearance of night. And the light forced its way up and out of her gaping mouth. At that moment, Stuart appeared from the darkness, grabbed my arm, and before I knew it, we were running. Our feet scrambled over broken glass, pummeling it further into smaller shards. I looked over my shoulder, and the horrid figure, light source and all, was chasing us. The light from her throat and mouth seemed to pulse with intermittent fury, and as we reached the metal frame of the building, she screamed words of hate and anguish, a rasping anger filled with nothing but contempt for the living. Before I knew it, we had escaped the gardens, that screeching creature seemingly constrained to the boundaries of that derelict building. We reached the fence, then the car, and then home, where I fixed both Stuart and myself a large whiskey as we tried to calm our nerves. As it turned out, Stuart had been on one of his investigations, as I'd thought. He heard stories of strange lights coming from the old botanical garden building at night, and thought he would check it out. He got more than he bargained for, that's for sure. At first, the old building seemed empty, but as the night drew in, he felt as though he was being watched. Suddenly, the batteries from his torch drained. The spare batteries he always carried on him were equally unresponsive, and so he was left in the darkness, alone. It was then that he heard the footsteps, and the woman's voice simply kept saying,
"I know you're here. I know you're watching me."
To Stuart, it sounded like she was pacing up and down, occasionally standing over him as he hid on the floor. God knows what would have happened if she'd found him. I'm sure you have realized by now that Stuart claims he never called me on his phone or sent me any text messages. Indeed, he dropped it in the darkness and still hasn't found it to this day. We talk about that night occasionally, and Stuart hasn't been on any more investigations since. He lost the stomach for it. And who could blame him? My unease with the memory of that night, however, doesn't revolve around the fear of meeting some spectral creature in the night. I intend to stay as far away from any haunted places as I can. It's more of a fear which grabs me occasionally when I really think about what that night meant. If that horrid apparition is in any way what happens to us all when we die, that we are filled with such hatred for the living, I'd prefer to believe that there is no life after death. For what we encountered that night was a twisted reflection of all that is good in each of us. And if no good can remain, I would rather not exist at all.
That was Is There Life After Death? By Michael Whitehouse. Performed and produced by tonight's guest, Felipe Ojeda.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
That was a strong start, pal. This one really taps into the fear that the afterlife might not be so peaceful as we hope.
Speaking of full-scale audio dramas, I'm about to wrap up the sequel to a series in which you played a big part in, Jeff. The Dead and the Dying, Act 2, by Leon Hamilton. Yeah, the idea that something pretends to be human but isn't? Oh man, that's classic nightmare fuel, my friend. You know what I'm saying? That moment with the thing in the garden, with the light in its throat? Oh man. That'll stick with me for a while.
You and me both. And before we move on, let's talk about something big you've got coming up. You're about to premiere a brand new horror production from Chilling Tales for Dark Nights creator Craig Groeschick.
That's right, Jeff. On Thursday, March 13th, I'll be premiering The Smell of Decay on The Ghost of 94. This is a deep, psychological horror piece that blends slow burn dread with some truly unnerving twists.
Yeah, I got a little sneak peek at the script, and let me tell you, this one gets under your skin. It follows Amir and Claire, a couple dealing with an unidentifiable stench in their home. At first, it seems like a minor annoyance, until the smell starts seeping through the walls, bleeding into their lives.
Exactly. And the scariest part? Amir can't even smell it at first. Only Claire can. That little divide between them grows, and before long, it's clear that the house itself isn't just hiding something. It's alive.
And not in a cute, "oh, my house has a ghost" kind of way. I mean in like a nightmarish, reality-warping, existential horror kind of way.
Oh man, you can say that again. But without giving too much away, the smell of decay isn't just about a bad smell. It's about something watching from inside the walls. Something that doesn't just live there. It wants them to join it.
So if you like horror that sticks with you, mark your calendars for Thursday, March 13th. And trust me, you're going to want to listen with the lights on. Eh, turn them off. You can handle it. Our next story takes us to a small town where a string of brutal deaths has everyone looking for someone to blame. But as one man soon learns, the real culprit is something far worse than anyone imagined. From James Colton, as performed and produced by Felipe Ojeda, this is Garringer's Dog.
"I still don't think it's a dog," drawled Rick. "Not a dog at all." I rolled my eyes, ready to make the same argument I'd been making for the last week. "But the wounds. You think a dog is the only thing that could take a bite out of a man?" Rick interrupted. "You think a man can't take a bite out of another man?" "Come off it," I shot back. "I know what you're thinking, and I'll say it again. It wasn't old Garringer that killed those boys. It was a dog. Coyote, probably." Rick sipped his drink pensively. But I knew he wasn't done. I could hear the gears clanking in his skull. "You know," he said at last, "they found that tribe in Africa, that tribe of, what do you call them? Cannibals?" "Cannibals," I corrected wearily. "Yeah, cannibals, that's what they was. They'd raid neighboring tribes and bring back the fat ones for supper. Oh yeah, a man'll take a bite out of another man if he's hungry or mean enough." I gave up. There was no point in arguing with Rick. He got an idea in his head and nothing in all the world could convince him he was wrong. Instead, I just stared at the window at the stretch of darkness between the tavern and the rest of the town. The blackness was formed by a dense spur of woodland spilling off the mountain. The road home passed straight through, plunging briefly into a deep hollow and crossing a sluggish little stream before coming out on the other side. It was there, where no one but the animals and the old hermit Garringer lived, that the killings happened. The first was that Preston kid. He worked part-time at the tavern, and one night he didn't come home. They found him in the hollow, great chunks of flesh missing from his body. There was no question it was a wild animal that did it. At least, no question, as long as your name wasn't Rick. We started back for home, and as we entered the wood stretch, our debate continued. "It couldn't have been old Garringer," I insisted. "Garringer's lived in the hollow longer than anyone can remember, and the killings have only been going on for a week." I felt mighty proud of myself for that bit of deduction, but Rick chuckled grimly and shook his head. "I already thought of that one," he retorted. "Got it all figured out. You want to know what would make a docile old man turn cannonball all of a sudden? I'll tell you. Cooner." My pace slowed. "No," I decided carefully. That can't be." "You don't think revenge is enough to turn a man?" "When I was 11, I replied, "my dog Floppy was hit by a truck and killed. Now, I felt all kinds of angry, but I didn't go biting the driver that did it."
"You weren't no crazy old hermit neither," muttered Rick.
We both were quiet for the next few minutes. Our boots kicked through the rotting leaves, crushing twigs and occasionally scraping against the gravel hidden beneath the autumn detritus. Rick suddenly spoke up,
A ridiculous grin slapped across his face. I bet Floppy was pretty floppy after that truck got through with him. I flashed him a baleful glare. That's not funny. Of course it is. He shot back, and his booming laugh shook the branches over our heads. It echoed off the distant hills and worked its way back through the dense trees, a distorted shade of what it started out as. Shh! I hissed abruptly, holding up my hand for silence. You hear that? Rick brought his laughter under control and listened. What is that? Coyote, I asserted. Rick craned his neck in the direction of the sound. It was a wild, stuttering howl, high-pitched and screaming. That ain't no coyote. The last traces of laughter vanished from his face, and his skin went pale before my very eyes. The sight gave me goosebumps, and what he said next made my neck prickle. It's human. We exchanged a quick glance, and all arguments of cannibalism and not funny jokes were dropped as we ran toward the noise. Rick was already reaching for his gun. Most guys who walk that road carried one these days. As we raced, the sound began to fade. The howls gave away to moans. The moans died away to silence. Soon the audio trail was lost completely, and we came to a panting stop. It's gone, growled Rick. I flashed my light about the woods, trying to chase away the shadows. There was a trunk of a huge oak tree, the scraggly branches of a thorn bush, and wait a second. There, behind the oak tree, something moved. Rick, over there! We trotted to the spot where we had seen... what? It vanished too quickly for me to positively identify. It might have been a tail, or it might have been a coat sleeve. Already my memory was distorting it. A sick groan drew my attention back to Rick, who was shining his light down at his feet. What is it? I asked.
I stepped in it,
Rick responded weakly, pointing at the ground in front of him. I nearly threw up when I saw it. I probably would have recognized the guy's face if I could have seen it, but it had been ripped clean off, gnawed to a bloody pulp. That was the worst of the damage. But there were great crescent-shaped gouges throughout the rest of the body as well.
Who do you suppose it is?
Rick asked with a tremor in his voice. I shook my head. Something in my stomach was blowing bubbles. Big bubbles that released showers of gritty mud when they popped, as I looked at the boot-shaped dent where Rick had inadvertently stumbled over the corpse. You still think it's old Garringer? I asked cynically.
I know it is.
He raised his flashlight to reveal a winding path branching off to the depths of the hollow. It was the road to Garringer's cabin. That doesn't prove anything, I snapped.
No. I bet if we paid old Garringer a visit right now, he would have blood on his beard.
Rick started down the path, and I tried to stop him. Whoa. You're not...
Of course I am, Rick interrupted. I'm gonna drag that cannibal out of his sorry excuse for a house and bring him to justice. Just you wait and see. As soon as that crazy's behind bars, the killings will stop. I guarantee it.
Before I could say anything, he was gone, loping down the road with his gun held ready. I couldn't let him go alone, so I chased after him.
Wait a minute, I called. Suppose you are right. Remember when they found that Wilmot guy, Anthony?
Yeah, what of it?
Come on, I pressed. You remember Anthony Wilmot? The guy was huge, and it wasn't baby fat. Suppose you're right, and Garringer is the one who did them all in. You're just gonna lay hands on a crazy who killed a strong guy like Anthony Wilmot?
Bet Anthony didn't have this, though. Rick replied, brandishing his gun. Besides, you got my back, don't you?
Garringer's cabin loomed out of the trees in front of us. By this point of the road, if you could even call it that anymore,
had become so overgrown it was a wonder the old hermit could get his old rusty pickup in and out for groceries, Rick went right up to the door and banged the handle of his gun on the woodwork.
Open up, Garringer. Me and a friend would like a word with you.
Hey, I hissed, tugging on Rick's arm as he waited for an answer. Look at this. I pointed at the weathered boards beneath our feet. A line of dark spots, brown in the glow from our flashlights, that crossed the porch and ended at the door.
Convinced yet? Snarled Rick. The old crazy couldn't even bother to clean up his trail. That's what cannibalism will do to you. Turn your brain inside out.
There'd been no sound from inside the house, so Rick knocked again. Harder.
You got 5 seconds to open this door, Garringer, or I'll knock it down.
I still couldn't believe, even as I stared at the morbid stains by my feet. Did Cooner's death really make the old man snap? Was he chewing up the townsfolk out of revenge? I shivered as pinpricks danced up my arms. I'd been one of the men who showed up that afternoon, accompanied by a band of others from town.
Cooner's gotta go,
the leader of our little hunting party said when Garringer met us on the porch.
Little Ruthie's in the hospital. Might have rabies.
Garringer protested, but we were firm. Two of us held him back while a few more went inside to fetch the dog. It was a nasty creature, mostly skin and bones, but with a savage bundle of muscle in all the right places, so you know it could mess you up bad if you weren't careful. How anyone could love a pet like that was beyond me. It was Ruthie's father who pulled the trigger and ended Cooner's life. Old Garringer was distraught, but we all agreed it was for the best. Couldn't have a monster like that running loose, not with children around.
That's it. I warned him.
Rick's resigned sigh broke me from my reverie. He took a step back and planted one boot against the door. It held fast at first, but a few more kicks splintered the rustic lock.
All righty, Garringer, we know.
Rick stumbled to a halt, and I nearly ran into him. It was pitch black in Garringer's one-room cabin, but our flashlights picked out the continuing trail of blood and followed it across the cluttered floor. Clothes, furniture, cookware. It seemed the old hermit's house was hit by a whirlwind. The blood trail meandered through the mess and terminated next to a dirty mattress. The blankets were tousled and knotted around in an irregular shape. We both stood motionless for a second as we processed the scene. Then Rick stepped forward, much of the confidence gone from his stride. He reached out and pulled back the sheets.
Well, I admitted nervously. He does have blood in his beard, and even some meat in his mouth,
agreed Rick, his face turning green.
But I think it's his own.
He dropped the corner of the blanket, blessedly hiding what was left of the old man's face.
We should get out of here,
I recommended. Get back to town and report the bodies. Rick nodded and turned gratefully away from the hermit's corpse. Together we made our way to the door, and as our flashlight beam swept across the opening, something black sped across the porch.
What was that?
Gasped Rick, seizing my arm in a painful grip.
Animal,
I breathed.
Ain't no animal I ever saw. Didn't make no noise when it ran by.
The words were barely out of his mouth when a hollow thumping tore through the air. A mad racing rhythm punctuated by the harsh tick of something hard scratching against the wood. I knew that sound instantly. Floppy used to make it when he'd go tearing along the hardwood floors of my parents' house.
Let's go,
I urged once the noise was gone. Rick was close behind me. We cast our lights back and forth as we reached the door, searching the porch for any sign of what we had just seen or heard. But there was nothing. I tried to keep my pace even as we made our way back to the road, but Rick kept kicking my heels, and before I knew it, we were running. The woods were full of sounds, the ruckus of our hurried footfalls, the wind in the leaves overhead, the cracking and breaking of twigs behind and to either side.
I still don't think it was a dog,
Rick wheezed. My frustration with Rick's stubbornness boiled over, and I shouted back at him.
Well, what do you think it was, then? A chipmunk?
I shot him an angry look over my shoulder, and in that moment, I failed to see tree root rising from the road.
Shit!
I went down hard, and my face buried in a stinking pile of damp leaves, and Rick followed suit, stumbling over me with a cry of surprise. My flashlight went rolling off into the forest, throwing its golden beam wildly through the foliage before coming to rest about 5 feet away. Rick kept hold of his, and I found myself staring directly into its blinding glare.
Oh, get that thing out of my face!
I groaned, shoving his arm aside so I could see.
You shouldn't have been following me so close.
Rick's expression froze the words on my tongue. His cheeks were covered in mud from a spill, and his eyes bugged out of his head like golf balls. He wasn't looking at me, but rather, something behind me. Before I could react, he held his gun out, and I rolled out of the way just before he pulled the trigger.
Watch it!
I screamed, although I could barely hear my own voice from the explosion rattling around inside my head. Rick leapt to his feet, his weapon still held out in front of him, and I turned to see what he was aiming at. Nothing.
Are you crazy?
I screamed, punching him in the arm as hard as I could.
You almost blew my head off.
Rick's hand was shaking violently, and I noticed his chin was quivering.
It was right there, he whimpered. I saw it.
Saw what?
I demanded. But instead of answering, he began spinning around, pointing his gun every which way as though responding to noises I couldn't hear.
Run, he snarled. Don't look back, just run.
He gave me a rough shove and I obeyed. Rick's mind was crumbling, and I didn't want to be caught in the dark woods when it gave way completely and he started scattering bullets. The trees began to thin out, and the moon worked its way through the canopy to illuminate our path. Ahead, I could see the lights of the town growing closer. Rick's footsteps pounded to my left and a little behind, his raspy whisper chanting,
Don't look back. Don't look back. Don't look back.
I spun just in time to see Rick's hands vanish into the bush by the side of the road.
Rick!
I shouted, drawing my gun and sprinting to the place where he had disappeared. Without thinking, I thrust my hand into the underbrush and immediately withdrew it with a cry of disgust. My fingers came back warm and wet. A violent din erupted from the bushes. Leaves thrashed back and forth. Something thumped heavily against the dirt, and Rick's voice rose above it all. High and shrill and unbearable. All reason left me, like a hatch fell open and dumped it all right there. I never commanded my legs to move, but they did, pumping up and down without feeling. I was there that afternoon. I joined the hunt. Mine was a face it would recognize. The freezing night air was sucked in and squeezed out of my lungs by the same machine-like force that propelled my feet. Clouds of it billowed in front of my eyes. Behind me, I could hear, surely as the drumbeat of my own heart, a heavy panting. I could hear the leaves and gravel in my wake being torn up by something hard and sharp. And in the back of my mind, I felt a rising howl. At last, I burst out of the trees, and the road was paved and lined with street lamps. Still, I kept running, obedient to Rick's final mandate.
Don't look back.
Not until I passed the first several rows of houses did I slow and risk a backwards glance. I could see the shadow of the hollow rising, spreading, scratching against the moonlit sky. For a second, I thought I saw two pricks of crimson, but those were gone so quickly, they might have only been my imagination.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
That was Garinger's Dog by James Culton. Performed and produced by tonight's guest, Felipe Ojeda. Well, this one had some serious small-town paranoia going on. The kind of town where people convince themselves they know the truth, but they really don't have a clue.
Well, as a small-town kid myself, I can definitely relate to the story. I love how it sets up one answer, the crazy old man with his dog, and then completely flips it on its head. From the start, everyone's convinced that Garinger is the problem, but the truth is way worse.
It really plays into that idea of urban legends, and how small towns always have those figures. The recluse, the guy everyone thinks is dangerous. But in reality, he wasn't the threat. He was the last defense against it.
Funny how that's always the case, right? And you really feel the weight of how wrong they got it. They hunted the guy down, thought they were solving their problem, and by the time they realized the truth, too late.
And the fact that the real monster had been playing along the whole time? That moment at the end, man, that gave me chills.
Yeah, the way it just walks into the light, calm, collected, like it had been waiting for that moment. That's a power move. Predators don't run. They just let you think you've won.
Right. And that last line, it leaves you with a sinking feeling. Like the nightmare isn't just beginning. It had already started. They just cleared the way for it.
Definitely. It's one of those stories that makes you question everything. If everyone else is convinced of something, does that make it true? Or are they just leading themselves into a trap?
And that's what makes horror like this so effective. It isn't about jump scares. It's about realizing too late that you were wrong all along.
Exactly. It sticks with you because it makes you rethink things. Who we trust, what we believe, and how sometimes the real monsters wear familiar faces.
And on that note, we've got one final tale tonight. One that takes us deep into urban legend territory. Ready for the last one, man?
Let's do it. For our final story tonight, we venture into the past. A town with a forgotten horror. An urban legend whispered in the dark. But some stories aren't just stories. And one man is about to uncover a truth far worse than he ever imagined. From Ryan Peacock, as performed and produced by yours truly, here is Remember Only the Checkered Clown.
People in my hometown don't talk about what happened during the summer of 1969. Urban legends, unsolved mysteries, and tragedies can be found in the history of any small town in the world, and mine is no different. Yet those who remember the Checkered Clown know why it is best forgotten. For the purpose of anonymity, I won't share the name of my hometown. Most of those who know of the clown only know twisted stories, and those old enough to remember aren't likely to share many details. Most of them would be of little help anyways. I'm quite sure there aren't many left alive who do know the truth. I may very well be the last one there is. And if that's so, it would be wrong for me to take the knowledge to my grave, as so many have before me. As it is now, I'm staring down the barrel of old age, and my youth is long gone. It's best to come out with it while I'm still young enough to remember everything. I was 8 years old on July 14th of the year 1969. It was a sunny day, and with only a few clouds drifting lazily through the sky. And even from a few blocks away, you could smell the carnival. It had been the topic of conversation amongst the boys in the block for a few weeks. Back then, our little town was out of the way, surrounded on all sides by a heavy forest with only a few roads connecting it to the rest of the world. Given the isolation, we didn't see much of interest passing through our little community. So, of course, the carnival was a big deal. I remember when my mom and dad led my brother and I to the field at the edge of town. I walked happily in front of them, looking back periodically to make sure that they were close behind. My dad held my little brother, Carter's, hand, and they lagged behind a little. He was only 4 years old, too young to understand where we were going, and I remembered he'd been especially grumpy that morning. He'd just been getting over a bit of a fever, so maybe that had contributed to his sour mood. Either way, I didn't let it dampen my own enthusiasm. As soon as I smelled the deep-fried funnel cake and popcorn, I broke into a run, following the delightful smells and sounds of music. Then I saw it. The long-awaited carnival, and there was an initial rush of disappointment. I'd expected something a lot more grand than what we had gotten. In the movies and on TV, carnivals seemed like an endless sprawls of games, rides, and food, with a Ferris wheel looming over all of it. What was set up in the field was certainly something incredible, but it was fairly bare bones. There weren't any rides, just booths with simple games and vendors with food. I saw a few of my friends at one of the vendors and had just been ready to go over and join them when a man had stopped me. It had been Mr. Woods, who had run the town library back in those days. I remember he'd always had a kindly smile and soft eyes. "Don't you want your tickets?" he asked, and in his hand I saw a string of ticket paper waiting for me. Mr. Woods' warm smile seemed to widen as he offered them to me, and I greedily snatched them up. I glanced behind me for a moment and saw my mom, dad, and Carter right behind me. My dad just smiled and waved me on towards the booths. That was all the permission I needed. I sprinted toward my other friends to join them in whatever game they had been playing, and my initial disappointment was quickly forgotten. I remember that my teacher that year, Mrs. Jenkins, was watching the ring toss game, and that our principal, Mr. Hughes, had volunteered for the dunk tank, which was practically a dream come true. For one glorious afternoon, me and my friends got to experience the carnival. We traded tickets for treats like funnel cake and candied apples. We'd run around and played. There was even a smiling clown in a baggy white suit, who sounded a lot like my friend Michael's dad, that painted our faces. That afternoon was almost absolutely perfect. I'll admit, I did lose track of my family amongst everything. I remember that I saw my mom sitting alone at a picnic table, with no sign of my dad or Carter around. But I never thought much of it. I'd figured Dad had taken Carter to play some games. I had my own friends to play with and my own games to focus on. I didn't want to drag my little baby brother around. What kid would? So I just played with my friends and enjoyed the carnival for what it was worth. We never paid much attention to what was going on in the background. I don't think anyone did. Most of those who saw something that day have their own stories. Some got a good look at the checkered clown. Some claim they spoke with him, and others only caught glimpses of him. I fell within the latter camp. When I saw him, he'd been walking behind the booths. He was dressed in a black and red checkered outfit and wore a cape that resembled that of the stereotypical court jester. I remember the way the bells had jingled as he walked. I'd only momentarily caught sight of his face when he'd looked toward the children in the carnival. Although I can't say I saw much, he kept himself covered in a black buskin mask. I remembered the mournful expression on it. It seemed so exaggerated. The mask looked as if it was screaming in anguish. I'd watched him for a few minutes as he passed, popping in and out of view from behind the booths as he walked purposefully away. He didn't hold my attention for long. Instead, I'd just gone back to my games. At the time, he'd made such a small impression, and I'm sure I would have forgotten him entirely if people hadn't begun to notice the missing children. We'd only been playing for a few hours before someone started calling out for their child, and in a span of few minutes, the carnival fell apart. I remember my dad emerging from the crowd of other kids who looked around in confusion as their parents called for them. He grabbed my hand and tugged me sharply away from the other children towards my mom. I could see her head darting around frantically, and over the cries of the throng, I could hear her yelling a name.
Carter? Carter!
There were tears rolling down her cheeks as she called for him, and her voice was drowned out amongst several other parents screaming for their children. I remember seeing several of my friends with their own parents, and I remember that some of them had even had siblings who were now notably absent.
Take Sean. I'll find Carter,
my dad had said as he pushed me towards my mom. She looked up at him, silent for a moment, before she grabbed me by the hand and led me away. I didn't want to go. I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't know where Carter had gone or why everything had so suddenly stopped. I just remember looking back at the carnival. I heard no music and the smell of food was barely lingering. What I did hear were the desperate cries of frightened parents looking for boys and girls they'd never see again. 32 children went to the carnival that day and never came home, including my brother Carter. Most of them were young, 5 and under, but there were a few older ones as well. As for what happened, well, no one really knew. A number of eyewitnesses said that they had seen the clown in the red and black checkered suit leading children by the hand into the woods. To that end, most of the town joined in the search party hoping to recover the children, but they found nothing, and after a few days, they gave up. No one ever figured out just who the checkered clown had been either. I don't think that anyone wanted to believe that they had been part of the community. I don't recall there being much finger-pointing at the time, but I can only imagine I was too young to see the full extent. If there was anyone the community blamed, I never heard anything about it. And in the end, it hardly mattered. The final consensus was that the clown had been a stranger, some unknown monstrous figure who'd taken advantage of the carnival to lure away some innocent children. Although the question of why and to where were left unanswered, for there were no answers to be found, no explanation and no why behind it all. Those children had simply been spirited away, and that was the only answer my little community had. Loss begat grief. Grief became bitterness, which gradually turned into acceptance, and as the years went by, people seldom spoke of the carnival. It became a sour memory for those who had lived through it, and an urban legend for those who didn't. Moving on after Carter's disappearance wasn't easy, but in due time I found my ways to accept that my brother was dead. Time went by. I grew up. Familiar faces aged and died off, and every year the memory of the checker clown became more and more distant. I never left my hometown. Some of my friends did, first returning only for occasional visits that became less and less frequent, before they stopped returning at all. I never resented them for that. One thing I've learned is that life calls people to different paths, and I'd made it a point to see enough of the world outside my little bubble to know that as beautiful as it all was, there was never anywhere else in the world that felt more like home than, well, home. Besides, The next 50 years were kind to our little community. Inevitably, the town grew. A lumber mill opened in the 70s that brought newcomers, and with them came growth. As the next 51 years crept by, the little hometown I grew up in changed into something modern and unrecognizable, and that fateful carnival was all but forgotten. Even the field that it had taken place in was bulldozed and replaced by a small suburb of townhouses. And as all this happened, I lived my life. I met a girl, married her, had kids, and got old. And even I'd stopped thinking about the carnival. Every now and then it would creep into my mind, but like any bad memory, I didn't let it linger. I decided long ago that there was no point in dwelling on the past. Instead, I just kept on working towards retirement and figuring out how I'd spend my twilight years, and I was happy just to have that. After the divorce, I'd gotten myself a little townhouse that I could comfortably afford. Originally, I'd bought it for me and my two sons to live in comfortably while they were over and inevitably ended up the only resident. My oldest son had gotten married and moved into the city about a year ago, and my youngest was finishing college in another state and shooting to become a lawyer. I was well enough alone, although I can't say it bothered me much. I had Toby for company, and while my mom had died long ago, my dad was still kicking as he pushed 90, and I'd stop by for a visit every now and then. Toby was some sort of collie mix. I think he had some healer in him. Originally, he had been my youngest son's dog, but when he had left for college, Toby just stayed with me. He was an odd animal, to say the least. Scrawny no matter how much he ate, anxious to the point where the fucking rain terrified him, and if I so much as stepped out of the house, he'd scream blue murder until I came back. He had these big, bloodshot eyes that looked so miserable all the time, and by God, was he a troublemaker. I can't say I didn't love the dog despite his faults, though I suppose it was nice to have something to care for, and I could tell that that mutt missed my boys as much as I did. We kept each other company, though. Every Sunday morning, I'd wake up early and cook a big breakfast of sausage and eggs. I'd make a few extra sausages for the dog and set them on a plate for him. He always seemed to appreciate that. Then after breakfast, I'd get his leash and we'd go for a little stroll through the neighborhood. We passed through what used to be downtown back when I was a boy, and on the way back up, we'd pass the suburb that had sat where the field once had. I didn't often think about it. The carnival was a faded scar, and the houses all looked so similar. Sometimes I might reminisce as we passed those houses, but not often. Usually I'd keep walking with Toby, lost in my own thoughts all the way home. That Sunday in March had been a bit cooler than most. Most of the winter snow had defrosted, but some fresh snowflakes drifted down from an otherwise clear sky that morning. I could see my breath out in front of me while I'd been out on my morning walk with Toby, and I let him explore and nip at the snowflakes as I walked. I can't recall what I was thinking about as we passed the suburbs where the carnival had once stood, but my mind was elsewhere. Toby's sudden barking was the only thing that brought me back into the moment, followed by the sudden yank on his leash. I'd looked up and caught the sight of a white fluffy tail flinging out around the house as Toby struggled against his leash. I felt it slip out of my hand, but I wasn't fast enough to stop it. That dog took off like a shot, barking threats at an innocent rabbit as he gave chase, and I was right behind him, yelling for him like a fool.
Toby! Get back here!
If nothing, that dog was fast. I'm not even sure I could have kept up with him in my prime, and by the time I followed him around the house, all I saw was a black and white blur in the distance, heading for the trees.
Toby!
That damn dog couldn't have cared less, and he vanished into the woods without so much as a backwards glance.
All right, you little bastard, I murmured as I reached the tree line. My boots sank a little bit into the mud, and I could see the vague shape of the dog in the distance. I headed toward him, calling out again, but this time, he looked at me. He was panting, and he had that stupid grin dogs always get on his face. I had a feeling he was going to draw this out and turn it into a game, since he hadn't gotten the memo that a 7-year-old dog wasn't a puppy anymore. As soon as he saw me getting closer, he took off a short distance away, then stopped to make sure I was still following him. While he waited for me to catch up, he pranced around and rolled in the mud, probably having the time of his life in the process. As pissed off as I was, I couldn't pretend it wasn't a little endearing. All right, you've had your fun, I said as I got closer to him and Toby just took off again. Asshole. I took another step forward, but as I did, I heard the creak of old wood. Not a twig snapping under my feet. No, this sounded more like rotting floorboard. There was a bit of an echo to it. I didn't have much time to wonder what the hell it was. It was just a split second later when the ground gave way beneath my feet. With a startled cry, I dropped down into darkness and was greeted with a splash of cold water. It hadn't been a long fall, but it had been a hard one. I landed on my ass and the water went up to my chest. A rancid smell filled my nostrils and I immediately began to gag. I'm not ashamed to admit that my lovely breakfast went to waste that morning. My body ached, but as far as I could tell, I wasn't seriously hurt. In the light that filtered down from the hole I'd fallen through, I could see that I'd only dropped about 10 feet. Looking around, my first thought was that I had fallen into some old sealed-off well. I suppose that was just my luck. Up above, I could hear Toby barking. He was close, and I saw him peek down into the pit and sniff at it before continuing to bark. I suppose the little bastard realized that something wasn't right and was doing the only thing he logically could about it. I fumbled around in my pocket for my cell phone and took it out. I thanked God I'd opted for the waterproof case, since I'd at least be able to call for help a little more efficiently than Toby was. Bless his heart for trying. With my phone offering some light, I was allowed the chance to see my surroundings a little clearer. The water beneath me was dark, almost black, and the muddy earth beneath my submerged feet felt uneven, as if I were standing on rocks. When I moved, I nudged something with my foot that shifted. On instinct, I looked down, and that's when I saw it out of the corner of my eye. It was almost completely sunken into the dirt wall of the pit, and most of it was submerged, but I still recognized what I was looking at. A human skull. The bone was brown and rotten, and the lower jaw had long since fallen off. I jerked backwards, bumping against the rear wall of the pit, and my eyes darted around frantically. Something broke underneath my foot. Another bone. My pulse was racing as I looked back at the skull that had sunken into the wall. It looked small, too small to be an adult. My attention shifted to the wall behind it and followed it up. It occurred to me that the well would have had probably more than just an old dirt wall. Hell, there should have been some indicator of where it had been in the first place to prevent old idiots like me from falling in. But there hadn't been, had there? There'd been no marker, no warning, nothing at all. Looking back at the skull, I could hear Toby barking frantically above me, and there was only one thing to do. With a shaking hand, I dialed the police. I was there on the scene when the police began to remove the skeletons from the pit. After they'd gotten me out and I told them what I'd seen, I stood by watching as the officers descended into the pit, or perhaps it may have been more accurate to simply call it a tomb.
We've got bodies down here.
I heard the officer call up. Bodies. That word hit me hard.
How many? I don't know. Skeletal remains. Multiple corpses.
The officer standing near the top of the pit looked pale. I can't imagine he'd seen anything quite like this before. Our little community didn't exactly have much crime in it. And this... I found myself staring at the pit as the officer inside climbed out. I barely heard what he said to his associate. My hand absentmindedly dropped down to the rest of Toby's head as he panted obliviously beside me. My mind was racing, trying to process all that I'd seen. My body ached, but I hardly noticed. That sick, sinking feeling in my stomach grew worse as I remembered the smell of popcorn and funnel cakes.
We'll call a team. Start getting them out of there and maybe start IDing the remains,
I heard an officer say. I saw him looking down into the mass grave, and part of me wanted to tell him that I already knew who was down there. I knew that there were 32 of them, and I knew all their names. I didn't say a word, though. Instead, my mind wandered back to Carter for the first time in years. Little Carter. That baby brother I so longed to avoid. The one I'd taken off on and abandoned the first chance I'd gotten. I knew he was in that hole, along with the rest of them. His flesh, long since rotted away, and what was left of his bones soon following suit. I wondered if I'd stayed with him, if I watched him like a good brother, whether he would have still ended up down there, or if he and I would be living our twilight years together. There was no answer to that. There would never be. But still I asked the question as I stood and stared at Carter's watery grave.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
I didn't hear a thing about the discovery outside of the surprisingly brief mention in the local news. If there was ever any word of it outside of town, it was buried beneath other, more pressing news stories. I wasn't surprised to read that they'd determined that there had been 32 skeletons, though, all of which belonged to children. That said, my lack of surprise didn't keep me from falling what I could about the find. The obvious question still hung over my head, and the discovery of the bodies provided precious little resolution. I don't suppose anyone could have explained why someone had dropped 32 children into a pit and boarded it up. I found precious little from what searching I did do, and it had occurred to me that there wasn't enough to announce on the news yet, but all that felt flimsy. 32 skeletons in a pit in the middle of the woods seemed worthy of more than just a passing mention. But then again, perhaps I was just an old man with skewed memories of how the world was supposed to work. I'd gone home after my fall and stayed there, processing everything. I'd called off work for the next day as well. I assumed falling into a pit in the middle of the woods was enough of an excuse to avoid work, and I knew that there was somewhere more important that I needed to be. My dad was a stubborn old bastard, and as he crept closer to 90, I was sure he'd never die. Despite his age, he still maintained most of his independence. I'm sure if I hadn't insisted, I handled his shopping. He'd still be out and about most days, ignorant to the fact that he wasn't as young as he used to be, and I suppose that made two of us. I didn't know if he'd heard about the pit in the woods. I hadn't spoken to him on the day I found it. I hadn't been sure just how to break the news to him, but I knew that it had to be done. I'd gotten up a little bit later that morning, much to Toby's chagrin. He didn't like it when he was denied his morning patrol of the backyard. I thought about calling Dad, but I wasn't sure just what I'd say to him. The news I had deserved to be shared in person. Eventually, once I'd taken care of the dog, I made myself leave the house. Time had not left my old house alone. The tree out front I'd once climbed with my friends was long gone, as was the stump. The porch looked different, and there was a new yet barren garden out beside it. Mom had set it up in her twilight years, but Dad had never been able to take care of it once she had passed. When I knocked on the front door, I didn't wait for a response. If Dad was still upstairs, I'd be waiting for a good 10 minutes for him to make the journey via the Stairmaster. I unlocked the door myself, and as I did, I heard footsteps upstairs.
"Hi, Dad," I called.
"Sean?"
Time and cigarettes had given my dad a rasp in his voice. He was clearly awake, but I didn't go up to bother him.
"What are you doing here? I thought it was Monday."
"It is. I took the day off," I called up. I wanted to talk to you about something."
"Oh? Well, give me a minute. I'll be right down. Make yourself at home. You know where everything is."
I did, although I couldn't let myself get too comfortable. I'd been out of that house for over 30 years now, and so much had changed. The old floral wallpaper was gone. Most of the furniture had been replaced, and there were only a few relics of the way things had been before. Stepping into the living room, my eyes were drawn to the pictures of Carter on the walls. Dad had kept all of them and lovingly framed them over the years, a grim reminder of what he had lost on that day at the carnival. On the mantelpiece was an urn with Mom's ashes in it. I heard the whir of the Stairmaster behind me as Dad began his descent, and I turned around to meet him at the bottom of the stairs. He only barely resembled the man I'd grown up with. In my memories, my dad had been a tall and proud man with a bushy mustache and stern eyes. Now, though, I saw only the vestige resemblance of the man he'd been. He was frail and hunched over. His hair was wispy and white. His jowls sagged down and heavy glasses obscured his eyes. What was left of his mustache was white, and he clutched my hand as I helped him out of the Stairmaster.
"Sean," he said softly and pulled me into a hug. "So nice to see you. Let me just get to my chair so I can sit."
I clutched his hand as I escorted him to the living room and helped him ease down into his worn-in, comfy armchair. I found a seat for myself on the sofa beside him.
"There we go. I'm not as young as I used to be, kiddo,"
he said, half laughing and half melancholy.
"Feels like only yesterday I was here with your mom and you were bringing the kids around. How are the boys, anyhow?"
"They're all right," I said. "Keeping busy."
"Good, good."
He nodded slowly and relaxed back into his chair.
"It goes fast, you know. Once upon a time, I was your age and thought I was old."
He laughed, eyes shifting over to one of the pictures of Carter.
"Look at me now."
He looked over at me now and noticed my polite yet vacant smile. His brows furrowed.
"You're a sorry sight. What's going on? Did you get fired?"
No, no. Things are fine at work," I said, I exhaled softly as I chose my words carefully. You see the news at all, Dad?
I don't bother with it. It's all bullshit and sensationalism these days, and I don't much care for what the world does anymore.
I nodded. His answer didn't surprise me.
Why? What was on it?
I took a few moments to answer. I found something the other day in the woods, out behind the suburb where the field used to be. The one where the carnival took place? Dad went silent. His eyes were trained on me, his brow furrowed heavily. There were some rotted wood planks in the middle of the forest that covered up this pit. I didn't see them, and I stepped on them by accident and fell in. I'm not injured. I didn't need to go to the hospital or anything. Just a few scrapes and bruises, and I had my phone on me so I could call for help, but I swallowed. The mental image of that skull embedded in the dirt wall of the pit rushed back into my mind. Had that been Carter's skull? There were bones in the pit. Human bones. Kids. I called the police. They got me out and said that they'd get the skeletons out of there. I took a look at the news last night. They said there were
32.
My dad whispered. I nodded. I felt a tear streaming down my cheek and wiped it away. I didn't hear anything about them identifying the bodies or dating when they died, but I looked up at my dad. He sat in his chair, dead silent. I saw tears streaming down his wrinkled cheeks.
I'm sorry,
he whispered. But I didn't say a word. He just stared at the picture of Carter across the room. His breathing had gotten heavier. I'm going to find out who we can talk to. Maybe ask about Carter, I said. If they can identify his remains amongst the other skeletons, maybe we could give him a proper burial. Still no response from my dad. His hands were shaking, and I stood up to draw nearer to him. I wanted to put my hand over his. I wanted to tell him that everything would be all right. Yet as I draw near, he grabbed me by my wrist. His eyes fixated on me, and he sucked in a gasping breath. Sweat dripped down his brow, and panic reared up in my chest. Something was wrong with him.
Sean,
he rasped, and I instinctively went for my cell phone.
Fuck! God damn it, hold on. Sean?
Tears and sweat dribbling down my dad's face as I dialed 911. I didn't even let the operator speak.
I need an ambulance, right away. My dad is having some sort of attack.
I blurted out, followed by his address.
Sorry.
Dad whispered as he clung to my arm. His eyes closed. And I held him close as the operator promised me they'd send an ambulance immediately. I held on to his every breath, my own heart racing in my chest, terrified that this would take a turn for the worse until, at last, the paramedics arrived. I suppose the news had been too much for him to bear. Dad's heart attack hadn't killed him, thank God, but as I rode with him to the hospital in the ambulance, I was sure I'd lose him, and I'd stayed as close to his side as I could until they moved him to his own room. We're going to keep him here for observation for a few more days, one of the doctors had told me. We need to be as sure as we can that there won't be another incident after we discharge him. I just nodded in response. Yeah, whatever it takes, I'll cover the cost, I said. The day wasn't even half over, and I already felt exhausted again. I suppose I'd known that I'd need to take another day off, although that hardly bothered me. My dad's health came first. He was asleep when I'd left the hospital. I stopped to get a burger in order to clear my head. So much had happened over the past couple of days. It was hard not to feel a bit blindsided by it all. My mind drifted back to my dad, stuck in his hospital bed. I couldn't imagine his mental state. 50 years of not knowing what had happened to Carter, and then, at last, something right out of the blue. I wondered what I would have felt if it had been my son. As soon as I'd eaten, I'd headed back to Dad's place. Since he was clearly going to be in the hospital for a while, I wanted to bring him some things from home. His medication, a change of clothes, and maybe some minor things that might make his stay there a bit better. I wanted to be there for him when he woke up. I wanted him to know that he wasn't alone in his grief for Carter. The door was still unlocked from where we had left it, and I pushed it open quietly. I glanced over at his empty armchair and at the pictures of Carter that decorated the living room before heading upstairs. I stomped off at the bathroom first to collect his pills, and then to the bedroom to get some clothes. I'd only been in my dad's bedroom a few times before, helping with some handiwork. The queen-size bed had one side almost untouched and the other unmade. The room was otherwise tidy and neat. In the closet, I spotted some of Mom's old clothes, still hanging up as if they'd been waiting for her. I suppose Dad had never been able to bring himself to throw out her old things. I doubt I could have done it either. It hardly mattered either way. When Dad died, they'd find new homes eventually. I pushed the clothes out of the way and found some comfortable-looking t-shirts for him to wear, as well as a pair of jogging pants with some old stains on them, along with other things. Most of his old clothes were suits or button-down shirts, which I ignored and pushed out of the way as well to see if there was anything else lingering near the back. Then I paused. In the low light of the closet, it was difficult to make out the checkered pattern. I was sure it was just flannel at first, but on instinct I grabbed it and pulled it out. The outfit hung on one hanger. The pattern was worn and frayed from the moss that had gotten to it over the years, but I would have recognized it anywhere. Black and red checkers. There was no sign of the mask or the hat, but there didn't need to be. I stared at the outfit silently, holding it up to the light as I tried to process what I was seeing, and I suddenly felt sick. I wanted to scream. I wanted to hurl the costume away like a venomous snake or bury it in the closet and pretend I had seen it. But I did neither of those things. I just stared at it like a goddamn fool as I realized the truth. I left the bedroom in a haze. The smiling pictures of Carter on the wall seemed to watch me, almost with an accusatory glare. I couldn't bring myself to look at them as the tears streamed down my cheeks. I still clutched the checkered clown outfit bunched up in a grip so tight that it turned my knuckles white. I was shaking, and as I descended the stairs, I headed for the door, consumed only by single-minded purpose. When Dad awoke, I sat quietly in the chair beside him. The machines beeped quietly around his bedside, and I closed the door so we could have our privacy. Outside, the sky was dim with twilight, and Dad's uneaten hospital dinner sat on a tray on his bed, along with his pills.
Sean!
His eyes were on me. He looked exhausted and weary. I didn't answer. I just stood up and tossed the worn outfit into his lap. He looked down at it, eyes glowing with a solemn recognition. His shaking fingers brushed against the old fabric. For a moment, I half expected him to have another heart attack. He looked up at me again, mouth opening and closing as he tried to figure out what to say. "Why?" I asked. My voice trembled with rage as I spoke. fresh tears gathering in the corner of my eyes.
Sean, why?
My voice echoed through the room, and Dad recoiled from me, panting heavily as the tears fell down his cheeks.
Carter was your son. I had to.
Dad's voice was weak and mournful.
We had no choice. The fever, the sickness. We didn't know what to do.
What? What are you talking about? What fever? What sickness? There was no fucking sickness.
There was,
Dad snapped.
You were too young. You didn't understand. It came on so suddenly. It was a smaller town back then. The nearest doctor was in the next town over. People started getting sick. They started dying, and we were scared. We didn't know what to do. The adults, the ones who were sick, they knew to stay away. But the children, they didn't understand. And it was spreading so fast. Then they started dying, and we couldn't watch. We made a choice, Sean. We made a choice all those years ago. The only choice we could make. We chose mercy over suffering. It was the only choice. To kill the children,
I whispered.
You murdered them. We agreed. No one wanted to know who'd done it. The men, we held a lottery and I lost. We put on the carnival to get the children who weren't sick together, so they wouldn't ask questions. So they wouldn't know what was going on. Then we rounded up the others, kept them away from the rest of the kids, and one by one, I took them into the woods. I took them to the pit we dug. I had a knife. They didn't suffer. Carter didn't suffer. Not like he would have if we'd let the fever claim him. And the parents didn't suffer either. They didn't need to watch their children die.
I stood there, watching my dad cry as he uttered his confession. I remembered the pictures of Carter on the walls, staring at him for every hour of every day, for the rest of his life after the carnival.
After that, I never spoke of it. We all agreed the checkered clown would be anonymous and we'd leave him behind. With the children gone and the last of the fever quarantine, we could move on. Start again. And it worked, Sean. It worked.
He reached for my hand, but I pulled away from him.
I'm sorry,
he whispered.
But it had to be done.
I just stood there, silent as my dad looked into my eyes. I couldn't find the words to say. All I could do was stare. Behind me, I heard the door open as a nurse stepped in. Everything okay in here? She asked. I heard shouting. I didn't give her an answer. Instead, I just pushed past her and out into the hall, leaving my dad behind. I got the call about his suicide the next morning. He overdosed on his pills. The nurse had found him just an hour before, lying in his bed and wearing that faded checkered clown suit. I imagine he died peacefully, and despite his sins, I'm glad that he did. Part of me wishes I'd had a better chance to say goodbye, but at the same time, I don't think I could have looked at him again without feeling disgust. I've heard very little about the skeletons uncovered in the woods. It's just a footnote in a legend that started in the summer of 1969. And I suspect that legend will haunt my hometown forever. But I won't let it haunt me. At long last, I know what happened that day. And I don't know if the answers have made me feel better or just left me hollow. Either way, it's clear to me that I can't stay here. It's time for me to find another home.
That was Remember Only the Checkered Clown by Ryan Peacock. Performed and produced by tonight's guest, Felipe Ojeda. This one was haunting, the kind of horror that doesn't hit you all at once, but instead unfolds in layers, getting worse the deeper you go.
Definitely. It starts off with this weird nostalgia. The idea of a childhood memory that's just slightly off. Something that should be innocent, but doesn't sit right. And then, before you know it, the story's taken a nosedive into real horror.
That's what makes it work so well. It starts as a personal mystery. Guy just trying to fill in the gaps from his childhood. But the closer he looks, the more horrifying the truth becomes.
And that truth is brutal. It's not just an urban legend. It's real. And it's so much worse than the stories made it seem. The carnival, the missing kids, the father's secret. It's all connected in a way that makes your stomach turn.
And what makes it even darker is that everyone in town played a role, whether they realized it or not.
I know. That moment when he finally puts it together, that his own father was part of it. Man, that hits hard.
That's one of the things I love about horror like this. It's not just about ghosts or monsters. Sometimes the worst things are the ones humans do to each other.
Ain't that the truth? And the fact that it's all covered up, buried, turned into a ghost story. That's terrifying in itself.
It taps into that fear of forgotten history. The idea that some horrors don't go away. They just get rewritten.
Yeah. And the final scene? That slow realization that the legend isn't just a story. That it's real. That it's still happening. That's nightmare fuel.
It leaves you with that unsettled feeling. Like even after the story's over, the horror isn't done with you.
You said it, brother. It's one of those endings where you just sit there for a second after and go, wait, what the hell did I just read?
And that, my friend, is the mark of a great horror story. When it lingers in your mind, when it makes you rethink the things you thought you knew, that's when you know it's done its job. And speaking of stories that stay with you, Felipe, as we wrap up tonight, let's remind our listeners where they can find more of your work.
Absolutely. You can find me on YouTube at The Ghost of 94. That's where I bring terrifying tales to life with original music, immersive sound design, and a full cast experience. I'm also on X, Reddit, and Instagram under the same name. And don't forget, tomorrow I'll be premiering The Smell of Decay on my channel. It's an original horror story written by Craig Groeschick, and it's a slow burn nightmare that'll stick with you long after the credits roll. If you enjoyed tonight's stories, you won't want to miss this one.
That's right. If tonight's tales have left you craving more, be sure to check out Felipe's work. Let him know you heard him here on Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. And while you're at it, you can support Chilling Tales for Dark Nights by leaving us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening. If you're watching on YouTube, take a second to hit that thumbs up, drop a comment, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. For even more terrifying content, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to become a patron and enjoy ad-free episodes. Your support keeps the nightmares alive. I'm Jeff Sturdivant, and it's been my pleasure to guide you through tonight's terrifying tales. Don't forget, we welcome a new guest narrator each Wednesday, so stay tuned for next week's surprise guest, where they and we will once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Got my water this time. Sweet dreams, listeners. Sweet dreams.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.